Hi, my name is John August. If you Google me, you'll see I'm mostly a screenwriter. I wrote Big Fish and a bunch of other movies. 2 years ago, I started writing a novel. It was something I'd never done before and knew almost nothing about. At the same time, I started recording interviews with authors and agents and publishers and everybody remotely connected to this book I was writing. I didn't know exactly what I'd do with all those interviews, but I had questions. And I figured I might as well get the answers on tape. Now my book is coming out. 2 weeks from today, you'll be able to buy it in stores. This podcast is about how that book got there, how I wrote it, how I sold it, and how publishing works. Not just as a business, but literally how books are printed and shipped. We'll be talking about success and failure, school librarians, book tours, typefaces, and how the shadow of Harry Potter looms over everything. As I'm recording this, I know how it all begins, but I don't know how it ends. Will my book get good reviews? Will it sell? Did I make the right choices along the way? You'll find out when I do. From Wondery, this is Launch, a podcast about making new things.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes, but let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
See, I've never made this kind of podcast, the kind with audio clips and music and ads. For the last 6 years, I've hosted a weekly podcast about screenwriting called Script Notes. One of the recurring bits is that my co-host Craig hates podcasts.
As you know, I listen to exactly zero podcasts, including this one.
Me, I love podcasts, all kinds. I currently subscribe to 65 of them. One of my favorites of the last few years is called Startup. You've probably heard it. It tells the story of Alex Blumberg as he struggles to establish a new company. Week by week, you can hear it grow and change. The basic format is that Alex talks directly to you and tells you what's going on, sort of like I'm doing now. When you go back and listen to it a second time, you realize there's some sophisticated techniques he's using. For example,
this will be probably the biggest and most long-term project of all your projects.
That's my agent, David Kramer.
You just have to make that decision for yourself, how you see the next several years of your life.
See that? I'm foreshadowing that there's a big choice I'm going to have to make. A life-changing decision. And I'm going to have to make it by the end of the episode. One of my other favorite shows is called Planet Money. They did this series called The Story of a T-Shirt, where they track the process of making a T-shirt from growing cotton to delivery. I love stuff like that. Process. So let's go back to the beginning of this whole adventure. Let's see how it all started. If you listen to a bunch of podcasts, you start to notice some tropes. Like, whenever you hear this kind of drone, you know something bad is about to happen, especially if there's an out-of-tune music box playing. And then the narrator says something like, "On June 19th, 1977, a young boy went missing in the mountains of Colorado. His family was camping in the Roosevelt National Forest along the Middle St. Vrain Creek. It was hot that afternoon. Still, average lows for June dipped into the 30s. A boy in shorts and a t-shirt was at risk for hypothermia, particularly if he got wet. The more immediate concern was bears. Black bears were frequently sighted in the area, attracted by an easy meal from the campground trash containers. Bears are foragers. They rarely attack adults. But a six-year-old boy alone in the woods might not fare as well. The boy's father, Hank, and his 11-year-old son, Bill, went searching for the boy. The mother, Nancy, and her mother, Helen, stayed back at the campsite. They yelled the boy's name until their voices went hoarse. This is the story of what happened to that boy in the woods. I should explain here. That six-year-old boy is me. I didn't get killed or abducted. It's not that kind of podcast, remember? This story about getting lost in the woods is really important for understanding why I decided to write this book. It pretty much explains why I am the way I am. Here's how my mom remembers that day.
We were up in Camp Dick, which is a Forest Service campground. We'd gone up probably on a Friday night, so we had had lunch. Your grandmother and I were sitting chatting, and you and your dad and your brother Bill were going to go exploring around, so you left. Pretty soon, I can't tell you exactly how long it was, but here come your dad and your brother, but no you. And I said, where's John? John wasn't there. I probably got a little teary-eyed, like, where's my kid?
Here's my brother Bill.
Mom started calling for you, and Mom was kind of freaking out, like, no, John, where are you?
So finally your dad and Bill decided they would go back out and look. And it seemed like it took forever. I was a smoker back then. I'm sure I lit a cigarette, you know, and probably smoked it down to the nub.
You know, she was scared. She didn't know where you were. You know, it's the forest, you know. You know, you don't know what kind of animals might be out there.
To my family, this is the tale of how John got lost in the woods. But the truth is, I wasn't really lost. This is what happened. See, I'd found this trail, and I was curious where it went. So I followed it. There was a little creek, and I made my way across the rocks. I wasn't actually that far away.
But I also remember, like, hearing you and not going back. Does that sound like me?
Yes. If truth be told, yes. I mean, because if you were busily involved in something, here again, you know, Mom could wait.
I could hear their voices calling for me. But there was another voice, this inner voice that was louder, more insistent. It was urging me to keep going a little further, to see what was around that next bend. So I kept walking. That's when it happened. I can't tell you what it was exactly. The air felt sparkly. The trees were vibrating. I had this feeling of awe, like I'd wandered into some ancient mystical site. I was 6 years old, and everything felt electric. I don't know how long I stayed there or why I left, but eventually I turned around and walked back.
And here you come, back. And, you know, then I really cried because I was just so glad to see you.
Something happened that day in the woods. I don't know what it was, but I have the echo of a memory, this sense of wonder. I've been chasing it all my life. Maybe you feel it too, that notion that there's something hidden just out of sight, just around the bend. All I know is, I see a trail and I want to take it. I'm still that boy in the woods. Let's fast forward 38 years. This is when I first spot the trail that leads me to write this book. It's October 30th, 2015. I'm in a hotel room in Austin, Texas. It's 9:57 a.m., and a massive storm is raging outside. I press my phone against the window to take a video because it feels like a movie. Winds are howling, lightning fills the sky. On a nearby building, I can see this American flag. It's whipping so fast, I think it might tear off. It's been like this for days. The airport is shut down because the traffic control tower is flooded. I mentioned the storm because it explains why I didn't leave the room much that weekend. If the weather had been better, I would have explored the city or had beers with friends. Everything would be different. I wouldn't be telling you this story. I'm in Austin for the film festival, but there's one work phone call I have to make.
Hello?
Hey, Kenneth, it's John August. His name is Kenneth Opel. He's a novelist. He's written this book called The Nest. It's about a boy who discovers that magical insects are planning to steal his baby brother. Some producers sent it to me because they think it might be a movie. That's most of what I do as a screenwriter. I adapt books into movies. Oh, first off,
yeah.
Is it okay if I record this?
Yeah, fine.
Okay. When I first read your book, it seemed really creepy for what I had originally been pitched as a kid's book. And so I guess I was confused about sort of like what were the rules of a book that is designed to be read by young readers. Do you get that question a lot?
All the time. I mean, I just came back from a week book tour in Italy and talked to a lot of adult audiences who had very, very profound sort of ethical and philosophical questions about the book and responded to it in ways that I was glad to hear about, because there's a lot of subtext to the book. Is it too scary for kids? But to my way of thinking, like I think kids read stories in an altogether different way than adults do, and kids are used to a diet from their very earliest stories of peril and death and and monsters, from Grimm, all the way to Beatrix Potter even. I mean, there's, bunnies get eaten and skinned and put in pies and people get locked in dungeons and towers. And so I think kids just sort of accept this sort of landscape as much more normal. And it's often the parents, with much more life experience who read these stories and are actually horrified.
I think he's right. Think back to the books we read as kids. So many of them are really dark. Hansel and Gretel, we all remember the end, the kids pushing the witch into the oven, but it starts with a father abandoning his children in the woods. That's like Stephen King dark. What do you say when people ask what genre of books you write, like sort of who the audience is for most of your books?
Well, in the current publishing market, middle grade is usually defined as a book for roughly 9 to 12-year-olds. And I constantly resist these, definitions. I mean, I like writing books that I thought had you could read them if you were a good reader at 8, or you could read them if you were 14. So I never really thought so much in terms of, middle grade, like what is that? I just wanted to write a good story.
This was the first time I'd heard of middle grade. You're going to hear that term a lot. It doesn't mean junior high. It's younger than that.
To me, like the middle grade is sort of the golden age of reading as a child. Like you never love a book as much as the books you loved when you were that age, like sort of that 8, 12. It's sort of that sweet spot for kids. Like a lot of kids sort of after 12, they sort of start dropping away. That's why I love that age group. Because it's also, it's still such a great time of life. It's still so full of curiosity and wonder and potential, and it's not cynical yet. The possibilities are still huge.
In most middle grade titles, the hero is roughly the same age as the reader. Think Harry Potter or Percy Jackson. The reader can easily imagine being in the hero's shoes.
I mean, there's lots of famous adult books with child protagonists, but for me, the difference between an adult book and a middle grade book, even if they have child protagonists, is that there's no gloss, there's no editorializing, there's no retrospective commentary on what that kid is doing. With a middle grade book, it's like all present tense. This kid, is having this incredibly intense and stressful experience that he's really not equipped to have, and yet he finds all this inner strength and becomes a warrior and defeats this monster really on his own.
There's sort of a template for middle grade fiction. You start with an ordinary kid, but then he discovers something extraordinary, that the world is different than he assumed. He goes on a journey, and the journey changes him. Basically, a kid goes into the woods. Something happens, and he's changed by it. Kenneth and I talk for about 45 minutes. I don't tell him, but by the end of the conversation, I have a new plan. Rather than adapt his book, I want to write my own. I see this new trail in front of me. I want to see where it goes. So that night, with the storm still raging outside, I sit down at my laptop. I open a new file, cursor blinking on the screen, and I start typing. I don't know where it's coming from exactly. I don't worry about that quite yet. It didn't look like a house at all. True, it had many of the things you'd expect to see in a house. Shingles, windows, bricks. but they didn't seem to be arranged in a house-like way. Instead, the building slumped
against the wooded hillside like a pile of debris left over from proper homes. To the left, a door hung 6 feet off the ground. No stairs beneath it. On the second floor, a blue plastic tarp stirred in the fall breeze, revealing the wooden skeleton of an abandoned room. The front door was hidden in the shadows of a sagging porch. From the back seat of his mother's car, Arlo Finch took silent note of all the dangers he saw.
It's now 2 a.m. I've eaten all the snacks in the minibar. More importantly, I've written 1,600 words, a chapter, a book. That's when it really hits me. This could be a book.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So many people say I'm going to write my novel or my script someday, you know, like that mythical someday when life is just easy and beautiful and you have money and a beautiful office and expanses of time. But someday it just rarely happens.
Grant Faulkner is the executive director of National Novel Writing Month, or NaNoWriMo. It's an organization that encourages people to write a novel in the month of November. In order to hit 50,000 words, I think it's 1,650 words per day that you're supposed to be writing.
Yeah, 1,677 to be precise.
NaNoWriMo has been around for almost 20 years. I've thought about doing it a bunch of times, but there was always a movie to write. Someone was always waiting on me to finish something. But it's November 1st, and I don't really owe anybody anything. I have a free month and no excuses. If there ever was a mythical someday, it's now. So I keep writing this book. I don't hit the recommended 1,677 words every day. I don't even write every day. That burst of energy, that zeal I had the first night, it doesn't last. I find myself doing writing sprints. That's where you set a timer, and then for 60 minutes, you only write. No Googling, no checking Twitter. That helps, but it's still a slog. By the middle of November, I'm not sure if I'll finish it. I'm not sure if I should finish it.
It's an activity of self-doubt. It has like so many masochistic components to it. You know, a writer is just constantly wrestling with that self-doubt no matter where they are in their writing career.
There's a phenomenon called the imposter syndrome. It's that sense that even if you're quote-unquote successful, you're not really any good at what you're doing, that you're faking it, you're a fraud, and everyone's going to figure it out eventually. I felt that a lot in my 20s. I was scared to show people what I was writing. What if this was the script that would reveal I didn't know what I was doing? By my mid-30s, I had a few movies made. Even if I was a fraud, they were real, and that's my name in the credits. That imposter syndrome? It started to fade. But something else had faded too. The uncertainty. The wonder. Grant Faulkner calls this expert rigidity. It's when you become so proficient at a thing that it no longer challenges you. When I first started writing movies, I didn't know what I was doing. It was hard. It was also exciting. Now, writing a screenplay isn't that hard. And honestly, it isn't that exciting. I know what's going to happen. I know these roads really well. Is that why I'm writing this book? So I can get lost again?
It's like traveling to a new city that you've never been to before. You're just experiencing the world in such freshness. And I do think that we lose that kind of childlike appreciation of storytelling the longer that we write. And so the more that we can do to go back and remind ourselves of that. And you mentioned one thing that I love is like learn something new. Like when I started playing the guitar 5 years ago, it was such an interesting experience to be a total beginner in another art form. And so I think people should like embrace that really as a New Year's resolution. You learn one thing new every year because it brings you back to that beginner's mind, and then you can apply that to your writing.
Maybe that's why I'm writing a book, so I can be a beginner again. At the end of November, I have written exactly 8,798 words. That's 6 chapters. I think they're good, but could it really be a book? I guess I should stop and tell you what I've written. The book is called Arlo Finch. It's about a boy who moves to a small mountain town in Colorado and joins a scouting troop called the Rangers, who can do magical things. Yes, it's literally about a boy in the woods. It's by far the most autobiographical thing I've written. I've plundered all my childhood memories of scouts in small towns and elementary schools. Even Arlo's last name, Finch, is a riff on my family's original German name. Except for the magical bits, it's largely my life. At the end of November, it's also largely unwritten. I've barely written a fifth of the book, and I already have the feeling that it only really makes sense as a series, like Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings. It feels like a trilogy, but do I really want to write 3 books? 15 times more work? I make my living writing screenplays, but this would mean giving that up for a while, and the books could tank. The uncertainty is exciting, but also terrifying. I need to know, is this even a good idea?
United Talent Agency.
Hi, David Kramer, please.
One moment.
I call the guy who knows my work best. David Kramer has been my agent for 20 years.
You did say something to me many years ago that always stuck with me, which is you sort of feel like you have in your brain a certain number of scripts to write, and you don't want to waste time, right? You don't want to use up any of that, any of those ideas or your brain space on the wrong thing. You only want to do it on the right stuff, so you got to pick your projects wisely. This will be probably the biggest and most long-term project of all your projects. You just have to make that decision for yourself, how you see the next several years of your life. And if ultimately you think about it, and I know you'll be thoughtful about it, and you come up with that decision after weighing all these things, then we'll go with that.
One of the conceits of this episode is that I'm still that 6-year-old boy in the woods, but I'm also a man in my 40s with a family and a mortgage and bills. To be clear, I'm not struggling. I make a good living as a screenwriter. I've written some big movies, and I get hired to rewrite other movies as well. Do I really want to give all that up to write a book? After the phone call with my agent, I decide I need to do more research. I'm not the only screenwriter who writes books. I call Seth Graham Smith. He wrote Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. It was a huge bestseller. He also wrote Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter and the movie version of it.
2 of the books were very successful and helped me out, and 2 of the books were not successful. And then the last book was such hard work. It felt like a slog. I was not as happy with the results, certainly not as happy with the reception. You know, when we're writing movies, again, for better or worse, there are filters between what we write, many, many of them, and what ends up being the experience that the audience has, whether it's the studio, whether it's the director, whether it's the cinematographer, whether it's the choice of the actor. Our words and our stage direction get interpreted, sometimes improved and sometimes not. With a novel, it's either all of your glory or all of your shame.
I think that's one of the reasons I'm most excited about writing this book. Screenplays are great, but they're basically a plan for making a movie. It's like you're building a house and everyone has opinions. You might be the architect, but you're not going to live there. So you adapt, you compromise. Because ultimately, no one remembers what was written on the page. They just want to see what's on the screen.
Writing a novel is as pure a distillation of your inner process and your thoughts and your intent as you're ever going to get, because it's just you, you know, to sort of you know, draft off of the way that Stephen King describes it in On Writing. It's you in a telepathic conversation with the reader. And so, you know, there's no filter between your intent and what words get down on the page other than your own choices.
I ask Seth if it's crazy to think that maybe I can do both. Finish the book while still writing movies. He says, yes, it's crazy.
There have been times in the last, you know, 6 or 7 years that I've just gone completely sort of functionally schizophrenic at times as a writer. I mean, you know, where I'd be, I can remember a time when my producing partner and I were in the second season of our TV show. We had this half-hour comedy series that we were running for MTV. I would be on set shooting, you know, essentially like a salacious, you know, teen comedy where we'd be making dick jokes and fart jokes and, you know, for the MTV audience. And then I'd go at lunchtime or whenever I had a minute into the producer's trailer and write this, and write Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, the novel. It was the weirdest time of my creative life, I think, was that year when I was doing those two things at once. And my head was spinning for 2 or 3 solid years before I sort of got a grasp on, you know, how to set boundaries and control your time and all those things that are very important and, you know, take a minute here and there for yourself, which is also very important.
I spoke to some other screenwriters who'd written books. All of them said it was incredibly difficult to do both at the same time. There are just too many words to write. Something always suffers. I asked one writer to imagine he had a time machine. If he could go back and give one bit of advice to his younger self, what would he say? "Don't write that book," he said. That guy had a trilogy that came out and just sort of vanished. Years of his life, 240,000 words, gone. Jeff Rodkey had a better experience. He's another screenwriter turned author. His first book series, Chronicles of Egg, sold about 50,000 copies. For a book, that's not a hit, particularly compared to a movie. When you look back at Chronicles of Egg, is there any decisions you would have made differently about how it sort of came out into the world in terms of what you would have done differently in terms of its reception, not necessarily even the writing of it, but sort of how it's presented?
There's one enormous thing, which is I would have changed the title. Chronicles of Egg, which was the series title, was kind of a placeholder I came up with that I thought was like, because the main character's name is Egbert, and, you know, people call him Egg for short. And egg is a horrible word. It's just, it's ugly. It's kind of awkward, you know. And I thought, you know, marrying Chronicles, which is a fancy word, with this horrible word egg would get you this sense of kind of ironic juxtaposition. But when you're selling books to 10-year-olds, nobody, ironic juxtaposition is not a bonus. And Chronicles of Egg also, for an adventure story that's actually a fairly like realistic and kind of gritty in spots adventure story, it didn't convey that at all.
After Chronicles of Egg flopped, Jeff went back and started a new series called The Tapper Twins. They're a hit. The first one was a New York Times bestseller. But it's still a fraction the size of an audience for a movie.
The one thing I've gotten over the course of two series is a real sense of diminished expectations.
Expectations. That's really what I'm wrestling with here. Why am I actually doing this? Am I expecting to have a hit? Hoping to? Sure. But there's just as much reason to expect it could be a flop. 3 years from now, will I look back and say, man, that was a waste of time? Metaphorically, I'm back in the woods, only now there's a fork in the path. To the right, I can just keep writing movies. It is a gentle, sunlit path. I know where it's going. To the left, the path is darker, steeper, but more interesting. I have this sense, this instinct, that it might take me back to that place I discovered 40 years ago. I hear voices calling me in both directions and warning me away. I'm not sure which way to go. For situations like this, I actually have a Latin phrase tattooed on my left ankle. Timium nihil nematis quidem, which translates as, let me fear nothing, not even fear. I got this tattoo when I was 23. It hurt a lot, but this advice has served me really well. Most of the things in life I regret are the things I didn't do, the chances I didn't take. Ultimately, I decided to go left. Timium nihil. I'm going to write this book.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, if I'm really going to do this, if I'm going to write this book, I'll need to get an agent. David Kramer, the guy you heard from earlier, he's my feature agent. He handles movie stuff, but books are a completely different beast. It's like the difference between a heart surgeon and a brain surgeon. They're both great, but you want the right one for the job.
Mary Pender's office.
Hi, it's John August calling for Mary. Mary Pender has spent her career as a book scout in children's publishing. David Kramer sent her my chapters.
I mean, based on the material that I read, it really felt like, and I mean, I hate to invoke Harry Potter, but this was the chapters that I read kind of had that wish fulfillment quality to it, and yet was so uniquely different to what Harry Potter was. It was not set in a school. It was set, you know, in a mountain. And it just kind of, it had this quality that was magic for almost everyday kids, which I think, you know, to some extent, the first Harry Potter book did feel that way. But as, you know, as the books continued, it was these special kids that had magical powers. Whereas when I was reading Arlo Finch, it was more kind of everyday kids who kind of could tap into that magic.
Next episode, we're going to talk about that Harry Potter thing. It comes up a lot. But for now, I'm excited she's excited. And here's what I don't expect. Mary thinks these six chapters she read, they're enough. An agent should be able to sell the series just off of those. Here's where I have to say that my experience is not typical. Most first-time novelists would have to finish the whole book. This is one of those situations where my screenwriting credits really help. Mary thinks publishers can look at these chapters and the movies I've written and say, yeah, he can probably do this. Still, I wasn't expecting it. I'd been thinking of selling as something that would happen later, after I finished writing. But now it's now. Mary says what I need most is an outline for the rest of the book and the series.
A publisher would want to see kind of where the rest of the story is going because, you know, as anything, there needs to be, you know, a beginning, middle, and an end. And since it's a series, obviously there has to be a through line that's going to work through the, you know, all three books. So what a publisher would need to see is kind of how that first, what that narrative arc of that first book would look like.
Let's talk publishers. In the U.S., there are five major houses. There used to be more, but they've all merged and combined in ways that make it really confusing. So let's add some sound effects. There's Penguin Random House, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, Simon & Schuster, Macmillan, and Hachette. There's also Scholastic. They're the ones that sell books at school fairs. They also publish Harry Potter in the U.S., which is, of course, a very big title. By the way, the book publishing industry is genuinely huge. In the U.S. alone, books are a $28 billion business each year. That's more than the NFL, NBA, and Major League Baseball combined. It's not a dying business at all. Publishers make money. But are authors making money? That's a little more complicated. In fact, the way authors are paid is kind of weird, so it's worth talking about. You've probably heard of royalties. That's the percentage of the retail price of a book that goes back to the author. For a hardcover book, it might be 10% on the first 5,000 copies sold, then 12.5% on the next 5,000 copies sold, and 15% after that. When a publisher buys your book, they generally pay you some money up front. That's called an advance. Let's say $10,000. You don't get royalties until that $10,000 is paid off. It's pretty common for books to never earn back the full advance. And Mary warns me that middle-grade books rarely sell for much money up front anyways. What matters is getting it to the right editor at the right publishing house who really understands the book. That's not Mary's job. She's a scout. She looks for books. She doesn't sell them. I need to find a publishing agent.
A publishing agent has kind of, you know, they roll up their sleeves and they do a little bit of editorial work in both shaping proposals, but also shaping manuscripts. So they work very closely with authors so that it needs to be the right personality match as well as the right area of expertise.
Mary puts together a list. There's one agent she wants to go to first. Her name is Jody Reamer. She's the agent of John Green, Stephanie Meyer. She sold huge books like Twilight. Naturally, I Google her. It becomes clear to me that Jody Reamer is the agent for this kind of book. I tell Mary, sure, let's try Jody Reamer. Meanwhile, I call Jeff Rodkey. Remember Chronicles of Egg? I want to let him know what's going on.
Yeah, so the agent I'm talking with is at Writer's House, and she seems great. She has other great clients. I'm just sort of curious. I don't know what...
Is it Jody Reamer?
It is Jody Reamer.
Oh my God.
On February 8th, I get an email from Mary Pender. I spoke to Jody. I'd love to get the two of you on the phone sometime this week. Let me know how best to proceed. This is all going really fast. Honestly, I kind of want to pump the brakes a bit, because it's feeling familiar. When I write movies, there are a bunch of people involved, producers and directors and actors and studio executives. Everyone has opinions, and I need to listen to them because that's my job. I'm getting paid. One of the things I've liked about writing Arlo Finch is that, so far, it's just been me. I'm not getting paid. It's all mine. If I call Jody Reamer, if she sells my book, then it's not all mine anymore. It's like, I started this whole thing because I saw this trail in the woods. Now I see where this trail may be headed. What am I afraid of? Success or failure? Or some weird mix of the two? Still, I call her.
Reamer.
She's exactly who I hoped she would be. And she digs my book.
This in some ways is my sweet spot, what you do, which is commercial with a slightly literary bent. And I love that, meaning that it's not sort of slapsticky. You know, there was real heart to it and depth to it, but definitely commercial appeal, you know, where you can see widespread enthusiasm for it. And so there are kind of a group of editors that I knew would be perfect for it. And that's kind of, you know, where my brain goes. Like, my immediate reaction is, okay, this will appeal to a lot of houses, a lot of publishers, a lot of editors. This isn't something where there are only two people who might get it and do well by it. I knew there'd be a group, and so then it's a matter for me to figure out which editors in the houses would be best suited for this material. And that's how, you know, I come up with my list.
Jody submits the manuscript to editors at all the major publishing houses. And now we wait. A few days pass. I distract myself with other things. The partial manuscript is only 70 pages, but that's still a lot to read. Jody tells me this delay is normal, not to worry. But still, those familiar doubts creep back in. What if it's not actually good? What if I'm a fraud, a fake, an imposter? A few more days pass. I haven't heard anything. I make a rule for myself. I won't check my email more than once an hour. That lasts one day. The next morning at 9:43 a.m., I see a new email. It's Jody. Subject, update. Exciting news, exclamation point. Give me a call when you get a chance. Jody. It's weird. I want to call her. I want to hear the exciting news, but I also sort of don't. Part of me wants to stay in this in-between moment when the news is good but vague. It's like I'm back in the woods. There's this electric, sparkly feeling. I know everything's going to change, but now I just want to sit here for a bit. Eventually, I dial her number. I know that when she picks up, it's done. This beginning, it's over.
From Wondery, this is episode 1 of 8 of Launch. To hear episodes 3 through 8 of Launch, listen exclusively with Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus for more exclusives, binges, early access, and ad-free listening. Available in the Wondery app. Launch is written and hosted by John August. This episode was produced by Ben Adair and Megan McDonald. Original theme music by Ma. Special thanks to Quinn Emmett, Dustin Box, Aline Broche McKenna. The executive producers are Ben Adair and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Wondery.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.